AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome everybody to another Sunday Roast, and we have a special guest as usual. Femi, please can you introduce yourself to everyone?
Hi, I'm Femi. I shout at Tories for money, and yeah, that's pretty much what I do.
Worthwhile job.
Yeah.
As well.
But I have to ask this, who are you going to shout at when there's no Tories left?
Well, the full title of that is I shout at Tories regardless of what colour tie they wear.
That's a good caveat.
Liz, can you introduce yourself, my lovely co-host?
My name is Liz Webster. I am the founder of Save British Farming, and I have been actively fighting Brexit now for well over 8 years, going into the ninth soon. So that's it. Still love talking about Brexit, and like to talk about farming, even though there's not much of it left since Brexit.
Well, you're giving us plenty of ammunition to start. I don't like, there's so much to pick here to choose. Okay. Hi, I'm Alex, also known as Political X. I'm an author, journalist, historian, and YouTuber. Today, we are going to go straight into it and talk about, you've given me so many things to talk about. Farming, Johnson, Tory leadership. We didn't even discuss that off air.
What's mental is that I was at outside Labour conference, they wouldn't let me in. And there was a Tory that happened to be there just sitting in the Costa. And I was listening to him talking. He was talking about how, like, they are terrified. They have an existential threat. He referred to it as a tidal wave in the form of Gen Z, that they are aware that Gen Z especially will never vote Tory. And what do you do with that? And it seems their response is just to lean into the reform vote. They've given up on that, because if they're going with either Jenrick or Kemi Badenoch, that's the only voter base they have now.
Yeah, well, that's why Johnson's out and about doing his book, because he knows this. The Conservative Party are brutal. And if in 2 years' time they're not polling, then I can see it. Johnson's going to come back. Bloody sure of it. And they'll be like, Johnson's the only one who can win, as he did in 2019. It'll be the same thing. It'll be like, it's not working out. So, okay, we're going to go with Johnson. And we could, if Starmer doesn't improve, or Labour doesn't improve, then we could end up with a 2019 deal between Farage and Johnson, and hey presto, we're back in the nightmare again. That's what I think.
Do you think that Partygate, Brexit, they can move past that? Johnson can still be popular enough despite all of that? What do you think, Benny?
I think Johnson is very much cooked as far as the voters go, because when you look at his original voter base, they hate him because of A, COVID, B, Partygate, and just not feeling satisfied with how Brexit has gone. And then when you look at the demographic shift, Gen Z has no time for Boris Johnson. And they go, one of the most disparate, well, depressing slash encouraging things about the years before Brexit was that with all the marches we did, all the protests we did, the demographic of those protests did tend to skew a bit older, even though young people were heavily anti-Brexit. And yet, when Johnson became prime minister, there was a F Boris march, which took place in London, which was the biggest demonstration of young people, biggest and most diverse demonstration of young people I have ever seen in this country. Because while Brexit was very technical, Boris Johnson was the value system behind Brexit, and young people effing hate that.
Wow. What were the, when you were on that march, what was the feedback you were getting? Why did people hate him so much? What was the thing that seemed to come up the most?
Well, he's just the face of the British right racism. He's the face of everything that's wrong with politicians that lie. He is your champion of white supremacy. I refer to him as Hitler's wet dream, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed racist. It's just... that's what he is.
He's a bounder and a cad.
But he's American. He was born in America, born in New York. His great grandfather's Turkish. How can he be a racist with all
and
that?
And French as well, yeah. How can you be? Well, because he really is the upper class sort of elite type, isn't he? You know, although actually he did go to Eton, but he was a scholarship boy, and that, you know, that he wouldn't have been amongst the, you know, the most, he would have been in the second tier there because he was a scholarship boy. I do know someone who's in a year with him, in the same school year as him. So he told me that he was very, very bright, one of the brightest students, but very, very lazy.
Oh, wow. Just came to him naturally type of thing.
Lazy.
Plus, there's just so much that's quotable from him. He's laid out exactly who he is so many times. Like, it's not even, like he said that he referred to black people in Africa as pickaninnies with watermelon smiles. He said the reason that Barack Obama removed the bust of Winston Churchill is because he had a part Kenyan's ancestral dislike of the British Empire, as if you have to have Kenyan ancestry to have an issue with the British Empire. He also said the problem in Africa is not that we were once in charge, but that we're not in charge anymore. He is a fan of Winston Churchill, who is on record as saying that there was nothing wrong was done to the Aborigines or the natives in Australia or the natives in America, because a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race came in and took their place. That's his champion. Like, he is on record so many times. Like,
he's an imperialist,
he's everything that Gen Z hates. Gen Z is fully decolonial. Gen Z is fully anti-racism, and Boris Johnson represents all the things they hate.
The issue is, though, going into the next election that I see, and because I'm always somebody that's always looking forward and planning, and with first past the post, you don't have to have a majority, and Keir Starmer has proved that. And now that they've got Farage carving up that vote, they can tweak it, and they did that in 2019. Boris's majority actually wasn't that strong. But it was Farage that helped him get in 2019. His popularity got better, actually, once he was elected, because I think people wanted to feel hopeful. But actually, up until the election, he wasn't that popular, if you look at his ratings. So I think he is a master at campaigning. And I think so is Farage. So I think the Labour Party, I would be very worried about them running with Starmer in the same model against those two. I would,
but
especially if they keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah, and here's the biggest irony. Like, Starmer is on record as saying that the reason why he won't pay for this or pay for that, or he's taken away a fuel allowance for this or that, is because the priority is that we have to grow the economy. And he's also said that the best way to grow the economy is to improve our relationships with the EU, but he's also ruled out rejoining the single market and customs union. So he's aware that his main solution for the cost of living crisis, he's refusing to do that. He's being blunt about that. And if we get to the next election and the cost of living crisis hasn't been addressed, and most importantly, people haven't seen that it is progressive values that are the reason why the cost of living crisis has been addressed, i.e. it's not good enough to do the right things, but keep saying, oh, but we support Brexit, we support leaving the single market, these are bad things, because you're then just supporting Nigel Farage's rhetoric. If we get to that next election and things aren't better, people will have lost faith in both the Tories and Labour, and that opens the door to Farage walking into power because he'll be the only option.
But already we have got people saying they're all the same. I was hoping that Starmer was going to be different. That's already fused in people's minds because of the winter fuel allowance being removed and the freebies. And the freebies can't be forgotten, because it's not the wallpaper. You only saw a photograph in the mail or whatever of the golden wallpaper. Nobody physically saw it. Every time Starmer appears on the camera, he's got a suit on and a pair of glasses. And everybody is reminded of it, which is why it was so stupid to think that it was a good idea to take them as a freebie. And now we're in this mess. And so I think that he's cooked his goose. If I was high up in Labour, I would be saying, OK, run this for a bit. But before the next election, we need to get somebody else.
Here's the irony of it. The reason why Starmer isn't doing the progressive policies that would actually improve the lives of working class people is because he's scared of what the right-wing press and right-wing politicians will say about him, which means that he's doing the things that the right-wing press and the right-wingers need him to do in order for them to take power, because he's not helping people, which is what the right is going to then use as a reason why, hey, he's not helping people.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't very popular going into office. And as I said, Boris Johnson wasn't either, actually, if you look at the polls before he assumed office and won the election. And what Starmer did is he was worried about losing political capital, so he decided to get these stupid Brexit red lines. And then he's completely squandered that political capital, because he did have a bit of an uptick coming into office, and he squandered it all with A, the winter fuel allowance, which was the stupidest decision ever, and then all the freebies. And so now where is he? How is he going to get popularity back? I did wonder this week when he said about it was a personal family matter to him, the Falkland Islands. Perhaps he hopes that he can try and save the Falkland Islands like Maggie Thatcher did, to try and raise his profile. Because, you know, she was in the bin until the Falklands.
I mean, yeah, that's all absolutely true. I'm not that surprised. I mean, he worked for the Criminal Prosecution Service. The entire aim is to throw people in jail. That's the aim of it. So you're like, that doesn't exactly like ring social progressive, like looking after people, does it? Like a friend pointed that out to me. I was like, yeah, that's a really good point. You don't sort of amble into that. You choose to go into that section of the service. So you're going, that already set a bad precedent. I will say, the stuff he did for the McDonald's people, are you aware of this? He offered pro bono support for the guys that were being sued for McDonald's for handing out leaflets about how bad McDonald's really was. I mean, you were just talking about Fevertree and being taken over by Coca-Cola when we were off air. Well, on this, yeah, they were handing out flyers outside McDonald's saying how bad the practices were and what they'd been doing outside and workers' rights. And McDonald's sued them, and he came in and he tried to rescue them by giving them free legal advice. He didn't have to do that. And that sort of, to me, that was like, that feels conflating in terms of like, he does want to volunteer and help the little man. At the same time,
I don't like this. It's all about working people. Because what is he saying? That as soon as you're not working anymore, then that's it. You're it's a bit like running a sort of queen bee running a running a hive. Like, I only care about the worker bees. As soon as you can't work for whatever reason, I don't care about you. And what about caring for children? I don't like this whole thing of working for working people. I think that's the wrong message as Prime Minister.
But that's the thing that resonates with the public in part because of the right wing press. That's that attitude, and that's an old school attitude. Like, you know, I've got many friends across the UK who have got an attitude, you do not take any benefits, and that's been drilled into them by their parents, who had the same attitude, and that you can always find something to do in some work. And you go, where's that come from? How's that perpetuated across the country? Because I hear it from several different places, and it's almost like they don't even understand that they've put money in to then take out when necessary, when they're in bad times.
And this is what really annoys me, that for the economy, giving benefits is not, it doesn't cost anything, because it just circulates straight back into the economy. The thing that costs us money is giving money to people like Baroness Moan, because they take it out of the country and put it into super yachts over in France or Italy or somewhere else, you know? Giving people benefits helps particularly local economies. And so what do? You go back to the workhouse where people go there to die? I mean, that's...
Some of them have been advocating for the workhouses to come back. In the Conservative Party, you'll go, like, actually advocating as a solution. Because they really think that the government has no impact on their lives. And it's just down to your actual choice of lifestyle. And that's why you should go into the workhouse, because you'll learn that it's either that or you get a job, and it's always better to get a job. They actually believe that. There's tons of historical evidence where the government has interfered, caused problems, damaged the economy, and brought it all down. And you're absolutely right as well with the welfare system. Economically, it makes absolute sense to have a welfare system. It stops you, like, we saw it in the 1930s in America where they didn't have one. And that's why they brought it in, because it just had a spiral of decline in the economy that kept going down. And it didn't seem to have a bottom.
It makes crime worse. It makes everything worse if your society isn't looked after. You should look after your people, and then you have a better. And you know, Norway is the absolute perfect example of how, and Denmark, perfect example of why this works. But America thinks it's a good idea to have guns. You know, this is the problem. We have got an obsession as a country with America, even though their values are actually abhorrent to most of us. But there's, you know, I know in my generation growing up, this whole thing about America and having all these television channels. You know, when I was growing up, we only used to have two television channels. And we used to have a test card on for most of the time. And, you know, I remember going over to Florida when I was about 15. I won't tell you exactly which year that was, so you don't work out how old I am. But it was like, wow, America has got everything, you know, Frank Sinatra culture and Bing Crosby and everything's big. And then in those days, we didn't have McDonald's over here either. And, you know, this sort of whole thing and going in and go, God, hamburgers.
Wow. Having to go to America for McDonald's is insane.
All I ever think, you brought up Norway. Do you know how many food banks they've got in Norway?
None.
The population similar to the size of London. Would you like to guess?
Zero. None.
Zero. Femi?
Two.
Last reading, one. One food bank. And it's the equivalent of London. And then here, you keep bringing up McDonald's. We've put it up several times now. There are more food banks than there are McDonald's. And McDonald's got to such a point in saturation of the market, they realized that they couldn't economically progress anymore globally. They had literally gone to every place in the world that they could financially make money. How insane is that? And now we've got more food banks. It's absolutely mental. It's just, it's all about, I think the thing that I heard the other day that was an amazing stat was price in the house in the 80s was about half your wages. So you could be earning four, and this is average. You've been earning about 14,000-20,000 in the 80s, and the average house price across the UK was about 40K. But it's not that now. It's only, our wages have doubled. So the average is about 30K, and the house prices are 10 times that. So you're never able to be in a position to create wealth. You're literally...
Well, no, and not only that, utility bills. We didn't, we did have a form of council tax, and then we had the poll tax. Mm. But the utility bills were nothing like we've got now. I mean, now, you know, your utility bills are as much as your mortgage. So with your council tax and everything. But the thing, and you see, this brings us into the farming. Mm. Food is cheaper than ever. It's the tiniest part of your income, whereas everything else is being squandered on everything else, which is why farms are being pushed down. But if we get back into the whole form of neo-fusionism, then the food prices will go up again because they'll have complete control of everything, no doubt.
Well, it seems like it's cooperating in the farming area, isn't it? They're buying out the small farmers in order to make giant farms and then do what they want with the property. Would that be a fair summarisation?
Yeah, since the Brexit vote in 2016, there's been over 200 super mega factories. A lot of them are American type style invest, you know, a Cargill. So when you go into Lidl or, you know, those sort of shops, and they sort of say, oh, this usually says farm on the label. And you notice, I don't know, Grange Farm, say, and then you notice the chicken, the pork, everything's got the same farm, as if you imagine it's coming from a cute farm. Well, it's not, just they're intensive. It's intensive farming.
Well, interestingly, Boris Johnson has been asked several questions this week because he's obviously been plugging his book. And someone, I think Nick Ferrari, asked him directly, give a score for Brexit. And he broke it down into two scores. And the first score, actually, I'm going to ask you that question. For national sovereignty, if you can even call it that, what would you give Brexit as a score, Femi?
In terms of actual sovereignty, I would say if...
Out of 10, and 10 being good, just to be clear.
10 being a complete win for sovereignty, 0 being absolutely destroying our sovereignty, I would put it at a 3.5. Because, we've essentially surrendered sovereignty in Northern Ireland, because the people in Northern Ireland, before 2016, had the ability to vote on their economic laws in the European Parliament. However, now, because the Northern Ireland has remained in the single market, but Northern Ireland isn't in an EU country, they don't have a say over those laws. So they actually have objectively less sovereignty than they did before Brexit, and they're a quarter of our country. And then when you add to that the fact that the UK is still having to sort of copy EU laws in order to guarantee the supply of goods, again, practically speaking, that's also less sovereignty overall. So I'd definitely put it at a 3.5.
Liz?
I put it at 0. We've lost complete control. We're not able to manage inspecting goods coming in any longer. That's why we've got blue tongue here.
Blue tongue virus is a disease that affects animals, mainly sheep, cattle, and other livestock. It's caused by a virus spread by tiny insects called midges. When animals are infected, they can experience symptoms like fever, swelling of the mouth, and a bluish colour on their tongue, which is where the disease gets its name.
We've got massive biosecurity risks. We don't have food security any longer. The EU don't have to supply us with food any longer. And that's why we are in this problem of delaying the checks all the time, because if they put the checks in, no one's going to send us food. Mm. So I think food is a massive, we die without food. And because of the delay for, you know, since Brexit happened, as I've said to you, food production here is crashing as well. So we also rely on energy from the European Union. And we've come out of the energy, whatever it's called, price guarantee. What is it called? The energy, for me, you know what it's called.
We can fact check now.
Yeah, can you fact check? We've come out of the European energy, there's a name for it, where you had a guaranteed price that you don't get, you don't have to pay. So now at the moment, we're paying the most for electricity in the world, I think it is. Certainly in Europe, anyway.
European energy guarantee.
Yeah. We've come out of that. Boris Johnson took us out of that. I can't swear, but I'd like to swear.
You can swear on here.
A complete fucking bastard that he is, yes.
Do you want to know what Boris's number was for sovereignty?
I know what it was. Yes.
10 out of 10. That was brilliant.
That's why I'm convinced that he's a traitor. He's not working for Britain. He's not working for us. He's absolutely pro-Trump, pro-Russia, pro-losing autocracy and losing control. So he is...
Boris being a traitor to the UK was established the moment he came out in favour of Brexit, having said previously many, many times, if we left the EU, it would be bad for the UK economy. So it was always a decision to hurt the UK in order to ride a wave of nationalism into number 10. Yeah. He was always, screw the country, I want to be king.
I will say he has adamantly denied that on all of his interviews. He's been pulled up on that and said, no. And his argument was, which was interesting, if we had lost, we would have been pariahs and no one would have taken us seriously. He's also claimed that David Cameron demanded that if he join his campaign to remain, and he would be in the top 5 cabinet position. But Cameron also said, if you join Leave, his exact words were, I quote, I will fucking ruin you, which is just like, wow, that's such a wild claim. I don't think that with David Cameron. But yeah, you're like, okay, you got to be prime minister. You probably do have this ruthless streak that we never really saw or envisaged. So that was quite interesting. Gibraltar, that looks like an absolute shit show right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm planning to go over there in November when they bring in the new checks, but Spain are just twisting the pressure. There is a group online that are suggesting that the way to solve the Spanish issue, right, which says so much about how they don't get how the world works, is that they have a free movement agreement with Spain, and you're going, they can't negotiate that, you fucking idiots. And then on top of that, you were like, that only suits Britain. That's not what Spain wants. Spain wants Gibraltar. Like, how do you not get this? They're lying. Do you not recognize the things that you do all the time? Like, how do you not see this mirror image? So the economic number, out of 10, Femi, what would you give it for the economy for Brexit?
What I'd say, what Boris had said.
What you would say. What would you give it as a number? Because we want, like, a realistic point of view.
I would say probably about a 2.
And why would that be?
2 on the basis of we didn't get no deal. So no deal, we managed to avoid no deal. I mean, people often question, was it worth fighting Brexit for so long? Boris Johnson explicitly was aiming for no deal at several points during that 2016-2019 period. So stopping no deal was a huge victory for the pro-Remain lot, which would have been absolutely cats and dogs disaster. Other than that, total disaster. So we've seen the damage done to every sector of the UK economy. So it is a complete shambles, but at least it's not no deal.
That would have been a hard border in Gibraltar and Ireland.
Yes.
That is the only way you could implement that. To which their argument is, well, we won't put that border in. And I could see everyone being reluctant to do that in Northern Ireland. Spain would have slammed that hard border down on Gibraltar instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Instantly, they would have put that down. They would have gone, yes, please, we're going to now financially ruin you and take that territory back. There's also Anguilla. No one ever brings up Anguilla. Anguilla...
relies on France to get its food, yeah, from St. Martin's.
From St. Martin's. And they didn't get a vote. They had no say. And you're like, what? And then we're told that this was democracy in action. And it's like, no, that's empire in action. That's dictatorship in action. You literally force something on a group of people that, and they're not allowed to say. Liz, economic number.
I'm going to give it a 1.
And why one?
I think actually, in some ways, I wish we'd had no deal, because I think if we'd had no deal, Brexit would have died in a few days, because it would have been so chaotic. No flights would have been able to take off. We would have had huge food shortages and there would have been carnage, and Brexit would have died very, very quickly, probably before COVID struck. but I've given it a 1 because I think that, I don't know this, but they keep telling me, and I haven't got the time to look into it, but they keep telling me there's some advantages for tech and AI. And so I'm giving it a 1 for that. But I'm also terrified of AI and what that actually means. I would feel safer to be slower with AI in the safety net of the European Union. So the 1 is a tentative 1. Otherwise, I don't see any advantages to Brexit financially at all. It's all disadvantages. But, you know, and OK, the 1 also includes the king, because the king is very, very wealthy since the Conservatives have been in power and Brexit happened.
400, 500 million a year, isn't it, Liz? He's receiving something like that. It's gone
but
up.
He was really generous with his birthday, that he went with a recycling food waste. I mean, his 17th fifth birthday present to the nation, even though the nation paid for his mother's funeral, he didn't pay an inheritance tax, and they paid for the coronation.
Mad, isn't it? They keep saying this about tourism as well as a justification, but actually tourist numbers went down during that period, which a lot of people don't know.
If we, you know, France still has tourists, and they don't have a royal family.
In fact, they have
the guillotine room does very well. I've been there. There's huge queues in there.
Wonder why. I always say, why does anyone want to have Charles's face rubbing up against your leg? That's just I mean, saying that, breaking news, looks like he might abdicate because he's too sick. Can you imagine we're going to fork out for another coronation and potentially a funeral and have 10 days of mourning again? Can you imagine that?
I don't want the 10 days of mourning. And I don't want that open casket thing either. You know, was it open or not open? Were all the people queued to go?
It was closed.
Can you imagine why they went? Why would you go into the sea? I don't. I'm sorry, I don't. I mean, I obviously, with my parents, I went to see my parents, but I wouldn't. I don't understand why you would do that.
There may be a point in the next few months where we will have had, in the previous, like, 3 years, as many monarchs as prime ministers.
God.
I quite like the Queen. She did a good job on PR, that little marmalade thing with the Paddington Bear, and I thought that the Queen was but now I think it's cooked its goose now. We don't need this any longer. And all of that dressing up in those robes, Charles and those things, I think it lends itself better to a woman than a man these days, wearing those ludicrous clothes. The Mr. Ben aspect of it, I think it's all a bit strange.
That was my opinion right from the get go. My opinion from the day it was going to be Charles. It's like, I don't want a king. A king is just so basic. I was cool with queen, having a queen because gas queen. But
she was motherly, sort of. Grandmotherly, yeah.
None of it grabbed me. And the simple thing I'll always say is, if I died, she wouldn't give a flying shit. So why do I need to care? Like, I get it. If you want to go and do it, be my guest. You know, more good for you. That's how you feel, and you want to support that. And you want to go in a queue and maybe see David Beckham. Can't imagine David Beckham turning up for Charlie Boy though. But for me, I'm just like, look, get on with it. Don't bother me about it. That's the best I can offer. She never.
I know, and we're going to have it with this rolling television the whole time. I had to turn everything off. God. It's really, I can't bear the thought of that.
Sorry, I forgot. I've just remembered how insane the news went about it for ages.
I find it quite distressing because, you know, I've lost, as I said, I've lost my parents. I also lost my mother-in-law in COVID. You know, we didn't even get to say goodbye to her. And we had a funeral of 10 people. And I just found this thing so excessive. I found it very, I don't know, draconian. And it was just like, you will do this. You're going to have this. You're going to mourn for 10 days. I found, and I'm really going to struggle to do that with Charles because I'm going to be like, I don't feel.
We got complaints about Philip, interestingly, and that was just one day. He only had 24 hours. And there were complaints written in being like,
he wanted to come back as a virus, did he? You know?
There was also that BBC presenter that when there was a vote in Parliament about. I think it was about, it may have been free school meals, it may have been about, it was some major policy about the cost of living crisis, and they had to switch from that to the king, to the queen's queen being ill, and it was just like, and he said something along the lines of, almost seems insignificant now compared to this. I was like, really? The poverty of millions compared to one old billionaire? Jesus.
Yeah. It's pretty wild, isn't it? And she definitely interfered in politics. We've got lots of evidence that she stuck her oar in with.
Of course.
The biggest lie that's
been going on since Elizabeth I. And, I mean, you're a historian, you know this, since the Spanish Armada. And that, this is where British exceptionalism was born, with that bloody Armada. Oh, we need people at the second of Spain. No, the bloody weather did. And these lies that they tell, it's just like, they're so obvious to me. I said, no, we don't do politics. Of course they do politics. She has a meeting with the Prime Minister every bloody week.
And an army of solicitors that she would use to send round is the claim. That's how she would influence government. The solicitors would turn up on her behalf to say, it would be in your interest to do this. Or,
let's
yeah,
be honest,
I mean,
it's she's an oligarchy. It's a mafiosa, isn't it?
But the whole system is. And Boris even acknowledged that. Because, again, we were talking off air about, no, we weren't. We were talking at the beginning about Eaton. Do you know how many prime ministers Eaton's produced in the last 57? Would you like to have a guess at that? What do you think,
it's
Liz?
It's nearly all of them, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's.
You think all of them went to Eton?
No. Not all of them, nearly all of them. One of them went to Winchester, didn't they?
Out of 56, I'd say 35%. No, 35 of out of the 56.
So give it as a percentage.
Okay, so I'd say 63.
I think it's higher. I think it's going to be. I think it's going to be close to 90%.
It's 30. 34. That's why when you said 34, it's about 34%.
That's me exaggerating.
But it feels like it, doesn't it? And then,
but
of course,
what are the others? Harrow, Winchester, St. Paul's. And I can't remember what they are. I need to look it up.
I'd have to check that as well. One of them, actually,
John
I'm not
Major,
sure. What, John Major?
John Major was a grammar school, wasn't he?
And he didn't go to university, interestingly. He's the only one that I'm aware of.
I liked John
Modern
Major.
Era. That's interesting. So Johnson, going back to the original point before we completely skewed off, 9 out of 10 for the economy. So that means he disagrees. Okay, long-winded. This means that he thinks that the IMF, the OBR, the OECD, Citigroup, Bloomberg, the Atlantic Council, Financial Times, New York Times, Washington Post, Oxford University, Cambridge University, Edinburgh University, and I think Cardiff University are all wrong. And he's right. The economy is a 9 out of 10. Just like that is wild.
Well, that's the premise of his entire thing. Screw the experts. He's been saying that for a very long time. Is that that's who he is.
What do they know?
He is a genius in terms of comms, I have to say, because the base that he's talking to don't care about those sort of details. And so he's just making them feel as if he's their mate. And Nigel Farage does a very similar thing. And so they don't, you just can't believe what they say. You have to take everything they say as a puzzle. Why have they said that? And that's what I do. And you just have to look at it and go, well, why has he said that? Because what is he trying to do? And that's the only way you can work it out. He actually disclosed on No Deal Brexit, going back to that, that he was never going to do it, and that he only did it to show Brussels that he was mad enough to do it. So that's what he reckoned.
He literally voted for No Deal Brexit in Parliament.
I know, and he just lies. I mean, the truth of the matter is that he doesn't care about any laws or any boundaries. He is totally and utterly a psychopath in that respect. Whether it's a psychopath or sociopath, I don't know, but he is an extreme person in that regard, and frightening, and shouldn't really be near power at all.
No, it's quite scary. And the you know, I found a clip from 10 years ago where Dermot interviewed him on Sky and just said this quote, and then, which I'll play.
Not comprehend. The indigenous population found themselves made strangers in their own country, their wives unable to obtain hospital beds in childbirth, their children unable to obtain school places, their homes and neighbourhoods changed beyond recognition. I mean, you'd agree with that, would you?
In a lot of England, that's true.
And you know where that's from, don't you?
I don't know.
Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech.
Is it?
So-called Rivers of Blood.
Well,
and Farage nodded along, like, as if it was totally normal and, you know, not that big a deal that he agreed with Enoch Powell. But interestingly, Robert Jenrick, who's in the, you know, the Tory leadership race that we just discussed, he's saying the exact same things. They're all, you know, saying migrants are causing problems. And you listen to that and you go, well, that's what Enoch Powell said. It's exactly what you said. It's just conservatives versus reform, and they're fighting for the same people.
It's desensitization. You know, it's the boiling frog desensitization. So that people immediately think that it's all to do with migrants, all the problems of them, and they just actually want to cook a toxic tribal warfare, you know, which is really dangerous. But they've done this, as we said, in the Empire. If you look at a guy called General Van Kitson, I actually went to school with his daughter, and he's written some books. He's actually, he died. Yeah, he was in a home with Alzheimer's. He died fairly recently. And he was in charge of the Mau Mau uprising. And it's exactly what they did. It literally is dividing and causing tribal warfare and conquering it. And that's what they did. And that's exactly what Winston Churchill did, you know, particularly in India with partition. And it's what they believe is the right thing to do. And they think that you're soft unless you go in and cause absolute carnage. And there is no other mindset for them to realise, even though Tony Blair showed them that there are third ways. You can resolve things intelligently by making sure that there is a compromise. They don't believe in compromise because they think that they have to be right at all costs. And that's what they've got with the Chagos Islands, even though they started all of that. Then, if they really cared about the Chagos Islands, they wouldn't have done Brexit, because right from the outset, we said, if you do that, you lose your buddies and you'll be up for losing the British overseas territories. I mean, that's exactly what said. Oh, you're scaremongering. And now there they are going, oh, they've lost the Chagos Islands.
it's quite wild, isn't it? Because it's James Cleverly that was part of the negotiations for that to take place, wasn't it?
And the other one is St. Helena, you know, that piece of volcanic rock where Napoleon was sent to. For ages, the St. Helenians were abused by the Conservatives under Margaret Thatcher's reign. And it was only Tony Blair that actually gave them British citizenship. These poor people were left in the most awful situation where there's no work there, hardly any, you know, getting goods in and out of there is really difficult. There was no aeroplane, no airport there. And Tony Blair eventually, went through the UN courts and everything else, and eventually they got their British citizenship under him. And but before that, they could only come and work here on licence, for a very, very small salary as slaves. And Tony Blair undid that because I used to work, I used to run a business for domestic staff. So I was actually running the agency throughout these changes. So they used to come in and work in very big houses as housekeepers and gardeners. And then they used to have a stamp in their passport and they were told how much the ceiling that they were allowed to earn. And Tony Blair, in fact, which is why I'm a big fan of Tony Blair, because, you know, I didn't agree with Iraq decision, but at least he did try and find solutions to these problems. He wasn't, you know, this whole empire spirit of taking advantage of people. But in reality, British people haven't come to terms with the fact of what British people throughout history have done.
Well, we're taught, we're not taught that. Like we're taught, like at school, my history education was World War One, World War Two, progress in invention of medicine, Industrial Revolution, and the Tudors and the kings and queens. So basically all stories where white British people were either the heroes or won wars or invented stuff or looked cool in robes. That's it. Like only good. So of course we get British superiority. Of course we end up in a situation where enough of our public genuinely believes that 27 countries need one country more than one country needs 27 countries.
Yeah, UKIP's quite an ironic name, isn't it? If you think about it, they've gone around loving how much the empire is good and everything else, and then the irony being that they want to leave everyone. You're like, what are you talking about? I feel.
They wanted to leave it because they weren't running it. Yeah,
exactly. Well, they are. That's the bloody thing. They are. There's a parliament. They're part of that parliament. They're one of the biggest blocks in the EU parliament. You get to select the leadership and the representatives in two other chambers. And
you've got to laugh with the EES scheme coming in, which is just, you know, controlling their borders. We are completely missing out on that security that the right wing so crave. It's bonkers, isn't it? I don't know. I think Brexit largely it's a decision to sanction ourselves. And it's known in doing so that you're really putting the most vulnerable and poorest under the most stress.
It was interesting that you said about this earlier as well, when you mentioned the positive of some of the areas in the economy, like financial services. I don't see how they would have been affected one way or the other by being in the EU or out of it, because they don't really deal with borders. It's all online. You know, it doesn't have the same VAT rules. It doesn't have the same restrictions because it's not goods going over, so they don't have to be checked. So I don't see how that would have made one jot of a difference one way or the other, or being able to deregulate it or regulate it. So, and it's not just financial services, it's services in general, I should have said.
Financial services, not my... I've got very little interest in it, but I've got friends who are in it, and all of my friends who are in it hate Brexit.
I mean, it's absolutely smashed the youth.
I think lawyers probably have done well from Brexit because we've needed more legal work.
It's a false economy. We'll probably need more debt collectors. Do we really need more debt collectors in the economy? Not really. I'll give you two interesting history facts. Just because you were talking about false history, and we mentioned India. Do you know where India gets its name from? Because you were talking about borders being split up. It's from the Indus River. Do you know which country that's in? Pakistan.
Yeah.
How much of it? I felt whoever drew up those borders and maps and everything else, I felt there was an element of really snide behavior. And when Fermi, you were talking about vindictive behavior or malice. Like, I mean, there's other stuff behind that. There's obviously all the deaths and everything else that took place with the partition, which was all created by the British. The other interesting thing was, Femi, you were talking about bad history never being taught. We had an interesting event about 2 years ago. Me and other history teachers found out that one of the courses that we had to teach was on the opium trade. And as a history teacher, you're meant to encourage the class to look at two sides. But in this section, this topic, we were told that we had to show the good side of selling opium to China and the bad side. And we were like, can you imagine them setting up a course on Escobar and going, can you tell your students the good side of him selling coke? Well, free trade and liberal economy and, you know, supply and demand. You know, you're not forcing it on them. They want to take the crack cocaine. Just like, so we actually had to campaign with the department that came out and said, why are you getting us to teach this? This is actually insane. Why is this in the syllabus? Like, are you trying to get us to advocate drugs? Like, what are you doing? But it was almost like they hadn't thought about it. Whoever created the syllabus choice just never put two and two together. And it's left over from part of the education. And India came up because the only thing I can remember from my history education was the Indian mutiny over cow fat being used on bullets, which for Hindus is like absolutely sacrilegious. But for the British, they're like, yeah, we get cows, we kill them, we eat them. Like, what's the problem with putting fat in the bullets? You're making a mountain out of a molehill. That was the thing that, like, sort of, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, as they say. Go on, Liz. I can see you want to jump in.
No, I'm just, I could go on about, yeah, the whole discomfort of the British Empire. So I'm Welsh, so I'm, you know, I don't come from that. I don't conform.
And yet you speak English.
Well,
so yeah, I'm reading the race report that was commissioned by Boris Johnson, and it says, in terms of how we improve British education, we want to create a teaching resource that looks at the influence of the UK, particularly during the Empire period. We want to see how Britishness influenced the Commonwealth and local communities. Now, the Commonwealth and local communities influence what we know about modern Britain. One great example would be a dictionary lexicon of known British words which are of Indian origin. There is a news story about the Caribbean experience which speaks to the slave period not only being about profit and suffering, but also about how culturally African people transform themselves into a remodeled African Britain. So, literally saying, it's not just about slavery was not just about profit and suffering, it was also kind of like a cultural exchange, like basically Erasmus with chains.
Do you imagine having to teach that about the genocide during World War II and going, well, we've got to look at the good and the plus and the negatives. What came out of all these amazing books and literature? Anne Frank's diary wouldn't have happened. Like, you couldn't write that. That'd be insane. And he's sewing around telling everyone that that's what we should be doing with other genocides. Do you know how many genocides that we were actually involved in total? Do you know? I'll tell you what, I'll give a more simplistic fact. Do you know of any nation that has committed genocide on two continents and wiped out 80% of the local inhabitants?
Probably.
I only know the UK. I don't know anyone else.
The Dutch were quite bad.
I don't know.
I think the British probably were the worst. Yeah, the genocide side. Yeah.
Of 80% of the population on different continents. I'm not saying the Dutch were good. They weren't. Or the Belgians. But on two separate continents and wiping out 80%. We're not sure about, and that's Australia and Native Americans. I don't know what it is for.
And New Zealand suffered really badly too.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting story in itself with the Maori, because they actually put up a damn good resistance, which is why they were treated differently in the end, because they did well at warfare. So we had to give them respect based on them being able to kill us. It's insane. Like, I don't understand half of this stuff and how it comes across. Like, I am definitely one of the, I don't know, I think it was interesting you were talking about Gen Z taking a different approach. I definitely feel like I've taken a different approach, but with history, because this is not what was being retold to me when I was at school. It was either very fact-based, we did this at this time and we were here and this event happened, or it was very, isn't the empire great and everything else. That was pretty much my education, so I've completely rebelled against it and just gone, well, we can't say that about Escobar, so why are we saying it about our opium trade? Like, that does.
I think what's interesting,
a straight line.
Because I'm always talking about food and Brexit, and it's always been the focal point of mine, surprisingly enough. And I remember getting into some discussions with some Lib Dems who, when we've gone into supposedly doing an India trade deal, I was like, oh, my God, we're going to be supplicants of India. And they assumed that I was talking about, you know, a whole horde of Indians coming over here and replacing us. I was always talking about control of food. For me, it's about food. And energy, you know, sovereignty is food. And if you don't have, I don't care about people's ethnicity or where they come from. It's just as in, this is an island, it's got people on it. I don't care where you come from, but whoever lives on this island has to have basic supplies to be able to survive. Mm-hmm. And but if you suddenly, and these people that sort of accept that we had an empire and we controlled great countries like India and Africa, large parts of Africa and the Americas, and yet they cannot understand that the same could happen to us. And the same, in to large extent, with Brexit is exactly what has happened, because we were part of, we saved our bacon after the Second World War by going into the EU. We had a lot of power within that, and we were able to kid ourselves that we still were powerful. But now we have handed completely that control away. We did with the Suez Crisis. And then, of course, we were saved our bacon by going in the EU, and we had power on the circuit, on the world stage. And then we've totally and utterly relinquished control, and now we're anybody's. And it's a question of who's going to take us.
Well, it seems like China and Russia and Iran. Sorry, Fanny.
The number of times I explained to Brexiteers, we literally had three times the voting weight of the average EU country. Because we had 73 MEPs out of 750, which is roughly 10%, which is three times the average when you look at 100% divided by 28. And that's the level of power that we had. So we were disproportionately influential in the EU. We've gone from that to having to copy the EU with no say. It is insanity.
And Boris Johnson managed to get people to think it was all about bendy bananas. And that is I recognize that his communication skills are second to none. You cannot underestimate his ability through the tabloid press, who are obviously on his side, to get people, no matter what age, to believe what he wants to believe. And that frightens me. And I think some of the Gen Z could be swooped up within that. And we have to hope they don't. But
I think there's an element, it was interesting in the chat that he had with Stephen Bartlett on DOAC, who basically said to him, and this was something that's come out of the book, that he's openly admitted that he was purporting the ideas of Brexit, but there was no plan. And I went, okay, you're not in charge, but you're advocating for something, but you don't know what it is. And you're advocating it so well, people are listening, but there's no plan behind it. So you don't actually know what you're promising. And Stephen Barnett came up with an amazing analogy. He said, it's like two of you come up to the cliff edge and you've brought the population with you. And David Cameron's saying, don't jump off. And there's no parachute. And Boris Johnson is saying, yeah, jump off. But I don't know what's going to happen. Who are you going to listen to? Like, it seems like the population went along with the Pied Piper of Pratthood and went, yeah, we'll all jump off. And then he's openly said, I don't know what I was talking about.
Yeah, but that's the beautiful thing about the ridiculous thing about Brexit, in the sense that both the politicians and the people blame each other. The politicians say we were only fulfilling the will of the people, but the politicians were the ones that told people to vote in that way. And the people who still support Brexit say Brexit that we voted for would have been great if not for the politicians. So both are blaming each other, which I find insane.
Yeah, wow. That's such a great...
As I said, Brexit was a decision to cause chaos, and that's what it's doing. Stirring things up, intensifying our agriculture, more Americanization, and it's a war on SMEs in particular. So, yeah, you can see probably why an American... pro-American person would be behind it. Although a lot of people say that they backed because they're so pro-British, including a lot of farmers.
Well, you know, if something like Nigel Farage, Boris Johnson and Donald Trump are all advocating for it, it's got to be good, right? It can't be bad. Robert Jenrick.
His wife as well. Gosh, it's scary. Hey,
what's wrong with Jenrick's wife?
Oh my God, she is. Have you not seen it? There's a profile in the Times about her last week. She is seriously scary. She's so ambitious. Very, very, yeah, very scary. Very right wing. Yeah, she actually is a lawyer, and she advocated for a lot of the Russians who were sanctioned. Yeah, to try and save them. Yeah, so that says it all.
I guess there's an element that you shouldn't shouldn't be too harsh on lawyers picking who they represent just because they're meant to just take up the case. I know you don't like, I know you feel like that, but you know, I'm quite a big advocate, pun intended, of lawyers sort of everyone's got a right to a defense and no one should be rejected. There's a big ethical question behind
but
that.
But her husband painted over those murals as well for refugee children, you know.
Even though she's an immigrant. Like, Robert Jenner's wife is an immigrant. She studied in New York and the UK. And then he's saying, he actually said, migrants have important things to the country. That would include his own wife.
But when they say migrants, they mean poor migrants. They don't they don't mind rich migrants, because that's why we've got non-dom status. Anyway, guys, I'm going to have to go.
Well, thank you so much. That was a brilliant chit chat. Femi, thank you ever so much for coming on. If you want to check out Femi's channel, link in the description. And thank you to my awesome co-host, Liz, for this week.
Don't forget my channel as well.
We will never forget your channel. That'll also be in the description. If you like this and you want this channel to grow and get bigger, hit that like and subscribe button. Thank you ever so much, everyone. Bye for now.
Be sure to tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
So you're a Trump supporter, you were telling us.
I get my MAGA cap out. He's just my kind of guy.
Make everyone angry again. It's not MAGA, but it's close. That's what it should say, shouldn't it? Such an ass. Elon Musk coming out. Who would have thunk it? The darling of the left turned to the right. Was he ever darling of the left?
I don't know. It's desperate. Nothing else here. We only have Musk. Only Musk.
We have an exclusive. We have two MAGA supporters on. You cannot say that our channel is an echo channel anymore.
I'm funding Musk.
What's Starlink like?
Well, it's a lot better than what we had before. You know, sometimes it would take 2 hours for a video to upload. Now it takes about 3 minutes. So I can't complain.
How big's the system? Is it like a big honking box?
No, it's about that, about a foot by half a foot, and it's thin. There's nothing to it. And it plugs
what, it's
in
like a laptop?
The router. Yeah.
And you can take it anywhere in the world now and have internet?
Well, I can, yeah.
Wow. That's pretty cool. You'll actually be able to go out filming live with the cows?
I could, yeah, if I could be asked to take it all out with it, yeah. Then the cows would trample all over it.
Yeah, because they don't like Musk. They know where their bread is buttered.